Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning. What's today? Columbus Day? October, what is it?
8th.
8th? I should know because in another week it's over. Anyway, we're going to talk about you don't know what you don't know, and things beyond that. Anyway, my co-host, Tammy Flanagan, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, soon to be in Money Magazine, in a two-week article in 2 weeks.
November's issue.
November's
very
issue,
tiny,
but it comes out.
Like 2 inches. But
the whole magazine's about you, of course.
Oh, yes, of course.
Anyway,
good morning, Bob.
Yeah, good to see you. And we have a special guest, Christina Sturgis. She's a certified financial planner, and you're going to explain what this other one is in a minute. CDFA. Did I say that right?
Yes, yeah, certified divorce financial analyst.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. So you don't know what you don't know. I like that. So we're going to talk about charitable gifting, divorce planning, financial planning. I guess financial planning is the tent, and these are the things inside the tent. There's a lot of things inside the financial planning tent, but we're going to focus in on charitable giving and women's issues, correct?
Yep.
I guess I'm going to have to be the outside looking in here, and so is Andrew. Good morning, Andrew. Anyway, so tell us just quickly what a CDFA is.
Okay, well, I'll start and say when you're working with an attorney, when you go to divorce, the attorney's role and their goal is to give you legal advice around what your rights are and to help you come to an agreement, ideally before you ever get to court with your ex or soon-to-be ex-spouse. What a certified divorce financial analyst does is work with your client and the attorney to help them understand the long-term financial impact of various different settlement options. So we're looking at, can you pay your bills in 5 to 10 years out from the divorce? Can you, what happens with your gross of your assets for each party? And it helps them to make proposals and counter proposals back and forth, looking at the long-term impact.
Great. All righty. So we'll get into that. But charitable gifting, I know you wanted to talk about that sooner rather than later. So charitable gifting, I think our audience understands what a donation is, but I'm not so sure that they understand what a plan is. So what is a charitable gifting plan?
Well, I think there are a lot of different things that you can do to give to charities. And I think that the first thing that I want to say is that because a lot of these strategies are involve taxes and are complicated, some of them are, and a lot of times you're working with a team. So you're working with your financial planner, you're working with an attorney that's going to review and draft any legal documents that are necessary, review any contracts, you're working with a tax advisor that understands the implications of all the different charitable gift provisions in the tax code. But I bet there's a couple interesting statistics I wanted to start with. One of them is that the average age the person drafts their first will is age 44. And they usually include a charity in it at age 49. So people do update their wills. And the average age of a bequest donor is 58. So that means they're dead at 58. That kind of surprised me. That's younger than I think most of us would hope.
Yeah. And I beat it.
Yeah, there you go. Congratulations. And that religious people, not surprisingly, are 3.5 times more likely to give to charities. So for people that are currently giving to some kind of cause that they're passionate about, one of the things to consider is when you die, do you want the charity to die with you? And that may sound like a silly question, but if your goal is to, you'd love to see this charity live on forever, there are some simple things you can do. Like if you're currently giving $2,000 a year to the charity, and they're counting on that for their operations, for them to do the work they're doing, consider naming $50,000 with a simple beneficiary form as an example for that charity so that that $2,000 can live on in perpetuity and you can make an eternal gift to that cause.
When you work with a person or persons and they're looking at what they want to give, in class we talk about it, but more often than not, I want my kids to have it. I want my friends to have it. And so I'll just throw out, well, you know, maybe something ought to go here. Do you ever work with the people that, you know, charitable giving is just not on the table, but they can be not talked into it, but they can appreciate it more if they understand what it does?
You know, it's interesting. The biggest really the biggest factor for whether somebody's going to give to charity is whether there are grandchildren in the picture. So people that have no children, no grandchildren, 50% of them give money to charities. People, once they have grandchildren, that number drops down to just under 10%. So you do have to have a charitable intent, but there are strategies. Even if you don't want to disinherit your children and your grandchildren, there are strategies that can be a win-win for everyone and still give to charity.
Okay. When we talk in class, I'm a tax type, so although I don't talk about charitable giving, but I'm not so sure the class always understands the taxation issues with regards to their, excuse the expression, 401k, better known as the TSP. It's not a 401k, but it walks and quacks like one. But anyway, it's fully taxable to whoever gets it, maybe not all at once, but they're going to pay taxes on it eventually, where a charity would not. So if they have a charitable desire, sometimes I say to them, why don't you take a piece of the TSP and give it to the charity and more to the kids, if you will, or the others, because they won't pay tax on the other assets. Do you get into that?
That was kind of like one of the examples you were telling me about, Christy, is a way that you can take money from the thrift, which is fully taxable, but if you donate it to a charity, then it's a tax write-off, right?
Right, exactly.
I'm getting out of my element here, but I know that was a cool example you had given me.
Yeah, so if a typical family in this area might have $500,000, to use a round number, in TSP money, assuming it's a traditional pre-tax TSP or 401k or IRAs, because that was tax-deferred money that was put in, it's never been income taxable. When the heirs inherit it, it's income taxable when they take distributions. So one of the things that people can do is give that, say, $500,000. They give it, instead of giving it to their children, they give it to a charity, like you talked about, Bob. And then they would get the tax write-off for that gift, of course, that they can carry forward. And with some of that tax savings from not paying income tax, like if you're a federal employee and you've got a pension coming in and you're not paying as much income tax because of this great charitable deduction, then you can take some of that savings and purchase a life insurance policy to replace some or all of that $500,000. And one of the great benefits of that is that when you receive the IRA, if I was a child or a grandchild, when I'm talking to my clients that are inheriting, you receive an IRA, you have to change it to an inherited IRA. You know, it's taxable as income when you pull the money out. If you receive a life insurance policy, you just present a death certificate and you get cash.
Tax-free
cash, which people like a little bit better generally and end up sometimes with more. $500,000 tax-free is a lot more than $500,000 in an IRA.
And the other thing you were saying, I think Bob's going to expand on this probably too, is the fact that you can't take the whole $500,000 and write it off in 1 year, but there's a certain amount every year that you could do from that gift, right?
It can't exceed more than, generally speaking, half their income.
Right.
Not always, but generally.
But still, that's a pretty nice tax write-off.
It's a great write-off. And then the other thing, upon their passing, depending on what percentage it is of the estate, it would reduce the estate from potentially, and this is a reach, potentially federal tax, maybe state. And we don't know what the exemption is going to be in 2013 going forward, but we do know now you'd have to have a lot of money for this to be an issue at the federal level, maybe not at the state. In Maryland, it's high. It sounds high, but it's not as high as it sounds. Excuse me, it's not as high as it sounds when you add in all the things the individual might have. Equity in the home, TSP, equity in investments, et cetera.
Right. A lot of us have more than we consider that we have, even though we're just working people and we have savings, but that adds up when you start figuring out the value of a home, and especially if you're listening in the D.C. area, these home prices are a little bit out of the norm across the country.
Yeah,
right.
It is. And although people listen to us well outside the Beltway and some places outside the country, everybody's going to have an estate and everybody's going to have desires as to where that goes. And so what we're talking here, I guess, about being the most as efficient we can, one of which is the charitable giving if we have that desire.
Is there other things you can do when you're working to do charitable giving that can kind of be a strategy rather than just taking money out of my checking account to donate?
Right. So if you are currently working, this isn't necessarily true for current federal employees, but maybe for their spouse or for a lot of federal employees I work with, they retire from the federal government and they go off and they work with a contracting firm or a consulting firm in the area. If you have an employee stock purchase plan at work, we had a client that a lot of these plans give you a 5 or 10 or even 20% discount on the price of the company's stock. And so people will choose to invest in the employee stock purchase plan. And in a particular case, got a 10% discount on the stock. There was a 6% holding period, meaning after 6 months, they can sell the stock. And so they would actually gift it. They gifted it to their charity and didn't have to pay the capital gains tax and got to give their charity that
full value.
Yeah, the full value of the stock, which is more than what they actually paid for it. They effectively gave their charity more than if they had just been paying them cash outright, assuming that the stock value, the price of the stock holds up, of course.
And that's true. And there are a number of folks listening, and they know other folks that aren't listening that do leave the federal sector. And in this area, depending on what they do, there's a high demand for their services outside the federal sector that would have potentially stock, because some people are sitting there going, no, we don't get stock. Well, some people do once mm-hmm. they leave, and that's one of the perks to leave, and that's one of the incentives the employer offers to get these people in these positions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I had a civil service client who received a lawsuit settlement halfway through their career, and that lawsuit settlement over time grew and started spinning off $10,000 or $20,000, depending on the year, in taxes. They also were charitably inclined. They gave 10% to their church every year, something that was important to them. And they ended up in this cash flow situation where, you know, as a federal employee, they weren't getting raises or increases, and they weren't able to give or put as much into their TSP as they wanted to. And what we ended up doing was saying, well, if you stop giving cash, giving your income every month to the church, and you start giving this asset that is spinning off all these taxes that are a problem and that is appreciated, if you gift the asset, you know, don't pay the capital gains taxes, then you can take that freed up monthly cash flow and max fund, put as much as you can into that TSP plan. And by doing that, you're going to get the deduction for the charitable gift, and you're going to lower your taxes this year if you're putting it into the pre-tax TSP plan. So that was a real win-win around.
Sometimes it's just a matter of looking at what you have, because you have different buckets. You know, you have your TSP, and you have this other income source, and then you have your salary. And just a matter of rearranging them sometimes is magic. Mm-hmm. And it's things that I would normally have never thought of. It's kind of cool.
That's true. And your point's good, Tammy, because some of the folks listening might be mid-career and they see these buckets, but there's nothing in the buckets. But as they go through the career, those buckets start to fill up with things. And what do I do? And if they know early on, it's better to know early, I would say, with regards to this planning than it is kind of after the fact. I got this, what do I do with it? And sometimes it's hard to move it into the bucket you want it to.
Well, and to your point, Bob, one of the mistakes I find people make is that they get life insurance typically when the kids come along to take care of their spouse or take care of their children. And then in their 50s, when they're really focused on retirement's right around the corner, they drop their life insurance because the kids are leaving the house and they don't need to pay for it anymore. And they don't think again, or they don't think at all about charitable giving strategies or legacy planning until retirement. They have some time to think about it. They're in their 60s or they're in their 70s. And then when we start saying, you know, life insurance might be a good leveraging strategy, or it might be a good strategy for you, it's so much more expensive to buy life insurance. And you may not even get it, be able to get it in the first place. Had a client, retired CIA. Had never been married, no children, was leaving all of their assets to, you know, brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews, and had this one old annuity worth $125,000, pretty inefficient, pretty high cost in there, out of any surrender period. And we just, for the heck of it, even though he's 78 and not healthy, had some health issues, we ran an insurance policy and ended up saying, you know, with $125,000, we can give you a paid up policy worth $300,000 to give to the charity. And he went ahead and took that risk. The risk is, you know, well, you could keep the $125,000 investment, and if you live to age 100, you might have ended up with more money in your pocket, or if you live to age 90. But he was betting on against his own health. He had had some good gut feeling about how long he was going to be around, and he decided that it's a leveraging tool. But boy, that would have been so much cheaper if he had thought about that younger. Yeah.
But still, that's kind of cool to even know that, because I would never think at 78 you could even buy life insurance, but you can. And even if he had health issues, they still were willing to underwrite it based on the paper of his right. health. You know, they're looking at the issues that weren't necessarily going to cut his life short, but you know, he felt that because of his issues that he may not live long enough to make that worth it. So that's kind of cool too.
Yeah, you never know. So you just don't know what you don't know. You don't know what's out there.
That's the name of the show.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So
I've learned a lot from Christy. I was like, I never thought of these things.
You're a closet financial planner.
I know, but I just know like the surface. This is like digging deeper. It's cool. Because there was even an article that I was reading my AARP magazine that comes in the mail, and they were talking about IRAs as an inheritance and this idea of the beneficiary IRA for the inherited amount. So it seems like this is a whole nother strategy besides just looking at it from the surface of leaving your TSP, let's say, to your children, as opposed to, you know, maybe you can do that plus do something else.
Yeah.
How do you get ARP? Your husband?
Must be an older person who lived in my house before me.
You know what's interesting? You can join AARP at any age and get all the discounts and the benefits.
Really?
You can.
Well, another thing
so
I didn't know.
So there you
know.
Go. Yeah, and I think it's like $15, $14 or something. It's very cheap.
I would refuse to read it when it first started. That
well, I've known
can't
people who will turn it back in because they don't want anyone to see them getting it in the mailbox.
And if there are any ARP people listening, I read it now. It's a great publication.
I think it's great. Yeah, I'll take
that. I think the strategy is you start receiving it at 30 and then nobody ever suspects anything.
That's right. then you don't mind.
A couple other things people may not think about that I've run into in the area. One is doing a bargain sale. You're a federal employee. You've decided you've had it up to here with traffic in this area, maybe the costs and whatever, and you want to retire somewhere else. And let's say you've got a house worth $500,000 and you know you're going to sell it and move and buy a retirement home somewhere else. And you have a charitable intent. So that's important. You have to have some kind of a passion towards a group that you believe in what they're doing. So some people will actually sell their home to a charity for $300,000. Remember, it's worth $500,000. The charity will give them the $300,000. And then the charity, of course, doesn't want to own and manage real estate. So they turn around and immediately sell it for $500,000. And this not only takes care of getting rid of your primary residence, but it also gives you a $200,000 tax deduction because that's the amount of money that you discounted to the charity compared to the fair market value. So that's an interesting possibility for people that are charitably inclined. Again, you have to make sure you're working with real estate agents that have experience in this. You're working with an attorney that's representing you and a qualified tax advisor.
It's not necessarily a do-it-yourself, put the sign up.
Please don't.
Yeah.
Don't try this at home without expert advice.
But it's still a strategy that a lot of people would have never even considered as a way to support that charity, but yet still not hurt you too badly tax-wise or financially.
Right. And if you're leaving the area, maybe you're not going to be contributing to that charity anymore. This is a great way of, a win-win lump sum, and then you're moving away and you're going to get involved in somewhere else where you're going to be relocating to.
How about somebody of less liquidity, somebody that wants to be charitable but doesn't have the six-figure amounts to give to the charity, but they know whatever their assets are, they want to leave X percent to charities. How do you... I've seen these wills where, 8% goes to da-da-da presidential library and 6% goes to the local religious organization and 7% and figuring that up. I mean, I guess it's good when it's drafted because then there's no argument what the dollar is going to be. It's going to be X percent of Y dollars. But when they put the dollar amount in and the dollar amount exceed the value of the estate, what do you do?
Yeah, we've had some issues where people haven't updated their estate plans, and maybe they had even a simple revocable trust, but in there they had language saying these percentages are going to these places. Or I've seen the opposite problem. This dollar amount is going to this charity, and all of a sudden the remainder is usually left to the executor or to the family. And the remainder, by the time you pay taxes or deal with administrative fees and so forth, and by the time the market corrects, you know, the charity ends up getting more than the remainder. You know, it's a problem. So you do want to really review your estate documents. And while I am certainly not an attorney, as somebody's financial planner, I will, when I send them to get their estate documents in place, I will review them and read them and see if I can understand them afterwards. And I've had clients that have come in giving the wrong asset to the charity from a tax perspective, and or naming children and grandchildren. One of the big problems I see is people naming children and grandchildren to receive assets, but they don't have any children and grandchildren. They have step or foster or kind of in their mind adopted children and grandchildren. But you need to be very careful when you're doing beneficiary forms or when you're putting anything in your estate documents that it has to be a legally lawful relationship, or it's better off to just say friend and name them. Otherwise, unfortunately, we've had IRAs that are going to, you know, son, daughter, and step son or daughter, and stepson or daughter is completely disinherited.
Because they weren't named.
Because it wasn't named as a stepson or daughter. It was named as my three children. And even though you might have lived with them for decades, if you did not legally adopt them and they are not your blood, they are not your legally lawful living children. I think I said that right.
So it's better to name them by name.
Name them by name and have the relationship correct, accurate.
Wow. And as Tammy always mentions, update, 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 right?
Yeah, I always talk about beneficiary forms because federal employees do file those generally the first day they're hired. And for some employees, that's the last time they looked at them was the first day they were hired. So, you know, if there's been a marriage, a death, a divorce, the birth of a child, you might want to go back and change your beneficiary designations or file new ones. And the other thing that happens to beneficiary forms, especially in the days of paper record keeping before we had electronic personnel folders, is that you'd have somebody's beneficiary form and you'd file it because you had to manually file it. And you might have filed it in the wrong folder by accident. And meanwhile, if that person dies, we can't find their beneficiary form. And the only one in there is the one from when they were first hired. So that's why they keep all of them. So I think every 5 years or so, I would file a new set of forms just to make sure that the one I want is in there, and keep a copy of it yourself. Because you'll ask employees, you know, do you know where your employee copy of that beneficiary form is? And 9 times out of 10, employees are like, well, I don't know. You know, I filled it out 30 years ago. But it should be something readily available, I would think. You know, I know where mine are.
Well, and also, just because you know where it is, unfortunately, just this past year, we had a client pass away. They had named their children as their beneficiaries, and the custodian of their account could not find the beneficiary forms and said there was nothing there. Never any beneficiary. They were going to pay out the entire retirement account to the trust, the estate, excuse me. And the children didn't know where to find it. This guy had lots and lots of files, tons of paper. And by the time this estate needs to get settled, there's no way that these children walking into your house are going to be able to find a piece of paper. So you need to label it, put it in a fireproof safe, put it in a safety deposit box, put it in some place that has, you know, bright red colors and arrows pointing to it. Saying,
or even talk to your children and say, look, my mother did that when she got older. She said, here, in case anything happens, this is where this box, you know, she had a fireproof box, and she said, this is the box you'll need. Mm-hmm. It has information about our house, information about our bank accounts. And it made it a lot easier, you know, even though no one wants to have that conversation, but it's an important one to have, I think, especially if it's your children and you trust them, of course, I hope. Not everybody, but we hope to.
No, sometimes the kids need a trust. They're not bad kids, but they're just not good with money. Mm-hmm. Krista, how does somebody get in touch with you? We've hit some heady areas here, and I'm sure there's some that are saying, what was that? I think I'd like to follow up on that. So how does one get in touch with you?
They can call our office. It's 703-986-3490 and ask to speak with me or Diane. Again, it's 703-986-3490. Or they can email me. And my name is Christina with a K. So KRISTINA. Sturgis, that's Sturgis, like the motorcycle rally, at ampf.com, that's A as in Apple, M as in Mary, P as in Peter, F as in Frank.com.
Okay. What's the X?
X is that I have two middle names. They don't know how to handle that. So they gave me X.
I thought it was because you did divorce planning.
Oh, you know, that's a good one. Ooh. That's why you knew that.
Yeah, before we get into that, though, I wanted one more question before we kind of change gears. And that is, if I am a federal employee and all I have to my name really is the TSP, that's my major asset in my house, let's say, and I don't have a lot of other IRAs and 401ks and other wealth that I've accumulated, I just have that TSP in my house. Would it still be beneficial for me to seek out help from a financial advisor? Because I'd still want to know, like, what's the best way to diversify my thrift? And what about charitable giving? Like, how do I incorporate these strategies? So could someone like that still benefit from getting help from a professional in that field? And if so, like, how would you find somebody?
Yeah, there are a few things. Yes, of course, I have a professional bias because I love giving advice and helping people. But when your primary asset outside of your house is a TSP plan, and that's the case for a lot of federal employees, one of the most important things that I think we've helped people do and that they should consider is that you've got investment options within the TSP. And what we've all learned after 2008 is that these buy and hold strategies where you keep, you know, certain the beach percentage. Ball, 25%, 25, 25, 25 or whatever, and you hold it forever, that can really hurt when you have a major market correction, and losing 40% of your wealth is not easy to make up.
Right.
So one
it's
of the things
an emotional event.
Oh, it was awful. It was awful for a lot of people. So one of the things that that we've done and that we suggest that people think about is to, instead of looking so long term, to also pay attention to what the current market is, where we are. So look at what are the risks and what are the threats in the market? What are some opportunities? So we've been discussing whether it makes sense to be in the iFund at all over the last 18 months. We've been discussing how much to put in G with interest rates where they are right now, whether we should put more in F in that corporate bond or fixed income strategy instead of the government bond fund. The G fund is a great fund. So these are changes that nowadays we are making year to year. So I think just getting advice around that, once you have, you know, $100,000, $200,000 or more in a TSP, you really do want to get some professional advice year to year on how you're going to allocate that money.
I wanted to mention that because I think a lot of employees who feel like I'm kind of average, I got an average salary, I got an average TSP, I don't have a lot of wealth, you know, is a financial advisor, is that asking too much? And I think the average person these days does need some financial advice because this is money that we have to live on someday, and we don't want to make mistakes, and we don't want to just throw a dart at the dartboard or use the beach ball to decide how to allocate our investments. So I just don't want people to be afraid of, you know, seeking that kind of help.
And they shouldn't be afraid to call us today.
That's
either.
That's right.
We're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. It's 10:34. It's Monday, October 8th.
Columbus
I should
Day.
Know this. Columbus Day.
But so a lot don't of our listeners us. Might actually be at home today.
So right. Don't call us after 10:58 because we won't be here. But we'll talk about how you can email us later. But phone right now, 202-465-3080. We've got a financial planner here. We've got a benefits whiz and a tax geek.
Yeah, you got pretty much a lot of the bases covered. Everything except for the mental preparation for retirement. That's the only part. But we could probably talk about that, too, if you want to.
I wanted to mention something about the TSP, too. Some people aren't aware that when you have a lot of money in the TSP and you are age 55 or older, you can take an in-service distribution. And sometimes with the TSP, it's a great investment, but there are certain asset classes that just aren't available yet. And sometimes people will take an in-service distribution for part of that money in order to invest in some alternatives or some other things that might help further diversify their portfolio.
Yeah, I think it's 59 and a half, right?
Is it 59 and a half?
Yeah, for in-service. But yeah, you're right. Because a lot of people ask, well, why would I do an in-service distribution? But it's for that very reason, because you might want to further diversify what you have within, you know, the five options within the thrift. You can move that and do some other things.
Right.
Which, again, you got to know what you're doing or else hire someone else to help you, because there's a lot of things out there you can invest in.
And excellent point. But also people should remember that you burned up your one-time partial.
If you do an in-service distribution.
Yeah. So later on, not that you need it later on, but you might not have that one-time partial when you retire. Not again, that you would necessarily need it. So you also had some other things besides charitable gift planning. We were talking about we want to talk about women's issues and divorce, but only after taking a call. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Steve from Potomac. How are you?
Good.
We're good, Steve. How you been?
I wanted to get the opinion of you, all three of you, about something called TSP Pilot. Now, some of my friends have used it and have gotten a good result from it, some kind of a private company that helps, kind of manage your TSP.
I think the TSP Pilot is a website, if I'm not mistaken.
Is it a website? I see.
Yeah, I think it's a website where federal employees, I guess, with a TSP account can go. And it's a group of people, and I'm not sure what their background is or what their area of expertise is, but they give advice as far as like things like Christy was saying, looking at the current market and where do you want to move your money today and tomorrow. And I think at one time it was kind of directed at day traders, if I'm not mistaken, where like every day you could go on
and
there.
That was
check.
Early on, I remember.
Yeah,
that.
And I'm not sure what it does now. So I'm not real. Have you heard of it, Christy?
No, I don't. I don't know about it to comment on it. I'm sorry.
I've seen it and look at it. I think it's helpful for people to read things, but not necessarily just the one. So they might have some ideas, and then you could see other ideas on other websites. I think if you did a Google on TSP money management, you would find other folks, other firms providing somewhat the same concept, probably different advice.
Yeah, but you know, money market folks charge quite a bit, and I was thinking, is there some cheap source for getting some?
You're never going to find it as cheap as what you got, but you subscribe to publications and the like, and with regards to your funds, like say money market, it's low now. Is it going to be higher later? The answer is yes. The question is when is later? Is the F fund now, and you can read articles on bond, and the F fund is effectively a bond, primarily corporate, some government. And then the I fund, like you say, is a little dicey right now with the type that it's got because it's broad coverage. And the
The S fund?
S fund seems to me. Listen, I'm not a financial planner, so I probably should say, Christy, what do you think of the S fund? But it's a little bit more seismographic than the C fund. But.
Yeah, the S fund is investing in small and mid-sized, primarily United States stock. And last year, it lost about 12%. It was a dicey year at the end of last year, so it's definitely more volatile, more risky than the C fund, but. What we tend to find is after a market correction that small companies are the ones that lead us out of a recession or out of a market correction. So it tends to be an important diversifier, but it may be something that in a short term you want to have less in. I'm not giving that as a recommendation right now, but you do want to adjust how much you have in there from time to time.
But some say you are within 5 years of basically mandatory distribution. Would you tend to be much more conservative with G Fund, but that nothing.
Right. So one of the mistakes I see people make is the market goes down, they get scared, they move everything into the G fund. It sits there for years. Right now, the G fund is giving less than 3%, and it has for a while just because of the nature of government interest rates. So it really depends on the environment that you're in. So it depends on where interest rates are. It depends on if the stock market has just gone up 20% or where that is. So it really depends on the environment when you're getting ready to retire.
I think people can do it themselves if they learn and are kind of self-taught. But then again, you get back to this, you don't know what you don't know. And I think that's where it really does sometimes pay the cost of hiring a financial helper or advisor so that you can save the money that you're spending. That's the goal of everybody. I think both the client and the advisor is to make money for themselves, but also to make money for their client. So you may be able to win in the long run by having that professional advice.
Steve,
but I want to really find out somebody who kind of specializes in TSP, and I haven't found anybody.
I think there are quite a few people in the.
But they are general money, you know, they are general financial planners. I want to find out somebody.
Google TSP okay. financial planners. Oh. You'll find more than a few.
Yes.
And here's a comment on your. You mentioned having to take money out. Affectionately, they call that the required mandatory distribution. It's spread out over a pretty long time, but with regards to the TSP, you need to be careful because it comes out pretty much in the same same allocation as to where you. Money is within the TSP.
Oh, really? Okay.
But remember, you can fool with that towards the end of the year. And, you know, if you so desired, throw it all in the G fund and then pull it back out in January. And then it only, and you take the amount out of the G fund and then you didn't destroy the other, you didn't hurt the other ones.
Right.
Or you put it into an IRA and we're getting way into the weeds here.
But I tell you, I really enjoy your show. It's the best show.
It's the best show on the station, right? Except for Mike.
No, that's so period.
And Tom's. Anyway,
and Francis and all the others.
One thing I wanted to mention about trying to save money in getting financial advice is, let's say you have $200,000 in a thrift savings plan. And let's say an advisor charges you $1,000 for advice, which sounds like a lot of money. That's 0.5% of what you have in your TSP plan. If they can charge that and give you guidance on how to reallocate your thrift savings plan, and let's say they take some money out of the international index while we have this turmoil in Europe, and they save you from losing a percent, they've more than paid for themselves. So be careful about being so fee conscious that you don't get advice and it ends up hurting you.
Yeah. I'm just saying that if somebody really was competent, they're worth it.
Okay, we got another caller.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling in. Good to talk to you again.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. Next caller, please.
Yes, my name is Daniel.
Hey, Daniel. Good morning.
Hey, I need some help. I'm 51 years old, and I don't have a 401k or Roth IRA or anything. My job offered me a 403, I think it is.
Well, you're in the not-for-profit arena, the... You're not working for Uncle. You're working for...
No, public schools.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I'm a mechanic.
Okay, well, you know, mechanics money and anybody else's money can go into one of these things, and it's much like the 401ks we're talking about. What drives you nuts is they all have different numbers, but they all do the same thing.
It's a
retirement savings account, and especially if the... the organization matches what some of the money you put in. So let's say you put in a dollar and they put in a dollar. That's pretty nice. You made 100% on your money before you started.
Okay.
Does your plan have matching funds? Does your employer offer, like, if you put money in, will they match you?
No, I haven't even talked to them about any of that. The only thing I know is they offered me a 403. Okay. And that was about it.
That would be a good question to ask them, I think, is there matching funds so that you want to contribute as much as they match? Because otherwise... that's free money that you otherwise wouldn't be earning. So that would be one basic thing, right, Christy?
Right. I find sometimes that the public schools don't offer a match, but they offer a pension. So depending on what system you're in, I would still, what that is it's an opportunity for you to save for your own retirement. And if you can, I would take advantage of that and put in whatever you can put into that.
Right, because the only other retirement income most people have besides a savings plan or a pension would be Social Security. And it's nice if you have all three, because if you have some income from Social Security, that's a nice base. And then you have your pension benefit, which is going to come for the rest of your life. And then the savings kind of is the icing on the cake. So if you can take part in all three, I think that's not a bad thing to do.
Daniel, have you been on the job long?
Oh, yeah, I've been about 10 years.
Okay, so you got 10 years, another 15 to go, right? All righty. So let's say you have 25 years, you'll earn a nice right to a pension, as Tammy mentioned.
Hopefully.
So you're going to get a monthly payment for life. And then if you can start to put away this other, along with Social Security, you'd be a happy guy. You'd be glad you called this morning.
I think I would contact your HR office and have them provide you at least some basic information about retirement benefits that are offered through your organization, because you might be surprised that there's more there than you even are aware of.
Okay.
And some states, actually, there are counties in both Maryland and Virginia near us where not only do you qualify for a state pension, sometimes you qualify for a county pension as well. So definitely something to look into.
Yeah, y'all smart.
Well, this is what we do. We don't know a carburetor from an air filter, but
you're smart for asking questions. I think a lot of people are afraid to ask the questions.
Yeah, there's one other thing I wanted to ask you too. I was watching the Susie Orman show one time. She was saying if you take some of your money and put it back into retirement for the next 10 years, maybe about $100 or something like that, for the next 10 years, you'll be okay.
Well, I think you're going to need more than $100, but that's more a Chrissy thing. But that's kind of what we're talking about here.
Okay.
A little bit's better than nothing, that's for sure.
Yeah. Right. And it really depends on how you want to live. If you like ramen noodles and you're going to live in Montana, that might work. It just depends on what kind of lifestyle you want in retirement. And, of course, if you decide to die a year after you retire, that would certainly be a cheaper retirement.
So how long are you financing your retirement for, and how nicely do you want to live? So got to set some goals. I think.
But you got the message from Susie as well as Christy as well as Tammy. Put some money aside.
Right, you're absolutely right. I have money coming out going through like a there's money to go on the side, but $100 every pay period. But it's not really working for me, just sitting there.
Okay.
Oh, good.
Yeah, now you got to make it work for you.
Yeah, that's why I called you. I just hit the station. I heard y'all talk. I was like, whoop, I just stopped.
Okay.
If you put it in your 403B, that's money you won't have to pay tax on this year.
A 403?
You said your organization offers a 403B. So if you start, instead of putting the money in your bank account, put it in a 403B plan. If it's money that you're going to save for retirement, and then it's money that you can deduct from your taxable income this year, which might be a savings for you as well. So it might cost you $70 to save $100.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Man, thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling.
Good luck. Thanks.
What's your telephone number again? Susie? What's your name again?
Christy. 703-786-3490.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling.
Take care.
Okay, we didn't get to
women's issues
and divorce.
Not in that order necessarily. Right.
But
that whole idea of the designation she has for being a financial planner who kind of specializes in divorce issues, that was a whole new thing to me. And I bet it's new to a lot of people, especially people who might be in the process of going through a divorce and haven't had that divorce settled yet. And what was interesting that Christy said to me was that a lot of people wait till the divorce is settled and then they go out and hire a financial advisor to figure out what do I do with what I ended up with. But she's saying hire a financial advisor prior to that to make sure for a lot of reasons, right? There's a lot of reasons why you'd want to look at those numbers and understand the distributions before you settle the divorce.
Right. There's a lot of... So remember, the attorney's goal is to have you reach a reasonable agreement and get that signed before you go to court. It's to settle something outside of court. And if you come to the attorney and you say, you know, I talked with my soon-to-be ex-spouse and I'm going to take the house. He agreed he's going to take his pension and I'm going to take this asset or whatever you would come up with. That can be drafted and it's a done deal. Once it's signed, it's a done deal. There are a lot of mistakes that people make. Oh, the biggest one I see is people wanting to stay in the house. For emotional reasons, maybe they still have kids in the house or whatever, and they don't realize that they can't generate income off of a house and that they've got expenses like property tax, repair, maintenance, and all of that that they have to factor in. Another big thing that Bob will appreciate is that a lot of people don't take into account when they're splitting the assets that receiving $100,000 in TSP money versus $100,000 in a brokerage, you know, liquid brokerage account money or cash are not the same things. And with a house, there's a basis. There are a lot of these assets that have a cost basis that you need to understand so that you know what you're going to net from this deal.
Especially if you're going to live in it for a while and you're the one staying in it and you sell it as a single person and you trade it off cash and then you get whacked with a tax bite. In a sense, I hope you do, because it means you made a lot of money. But nonetheless, people do not like paying taxes on the sale of a residence, especially if they didn't think they had to because it came via a divorce.
Right. Well, the point Christy was making, too, is if you did take the house as part of the settlement and after 6 months to a year, you decide, gee whiz, I didn't realize I have to cut the grass. I got to pay all the bills. I've got to paint the outside, put a new roof on. I don't have money to do that. So now I have to sell the house. And it may not be worth as much, you know, if it's a down market or if I have trouble getting the sale. So,
again, or if they hadn't repaired it.
Or if, yeah, if it's not been kept up.
Yeah, that was the tragedy of what we saw a lot in 2007, 8, 9, is that people were getting the house as a divorce asset. And then the house was dropping in value and they gave away an account sitting there, whether it was a TSP or another investment account sitting there worth $100,000, $200,000 because they thought they had that in equity in their house. And they didn't factor in things like a 6% realtor commission and taxes and so forth. So that was really tragic. And that's something, it's a something that people can, if you work with a qualified divorce analyst, you can look at these things and say, well, this is what I think. Just before you sign that property settlement agreement, talk to somebody, get somebody to look and say, this is where you're going to be in 1 year, 5 year, 10 years, 20 years out if you take these assets and he takes those assets. And this is your ability to pay your bills. And, you know, your cash flow looks okay. Your ability to pay your bills looks okay right now. But when you retire, you're in trouble. One of the neatest things I saw was a case where a client could... They realized with women, sometimes they don't realize that we have to make a lifestyle adjustment. In fact, one statistic is that after divorce, women typically see a 45% decrease in their lifestyle. So if we can see that decrease and act on it as soon as possible and either sell the home and split all those costs with the spouse as part of the divorce decree, or we can move out and downsize or go get trained and go back full time. I've seen sometimes the divorce decree, the property settlement agreement, allow for the other spouse to pay for the tuition or the cost to get the spouse trained and up and running and in the career force again. So think about these things before you sign a property settlement agreement.
You have a talking point here, and I like it. What are some ways women can sabotage their own retirement?
So I started mentioning two right off the bat, the biggest two. One is taking the house. And leaving the pension on the table, leaving the other assets on the table. Second is obviously not talking with or looking at the long-term financial impact of the settlement agreement. You know, divorce, I've been through it. A lot of people have. And it is such a hard emotional time. You just are drained and exhausted. Right. You just want it done. And so many people, when they're in that emotional frame, make decisions just to get the darn thing done. And then when they're out of that emotional place 2 and 5 years down the road, they go, oh, my gosh, I gave him his entire pension, or I gave away this entire asset just to get it done. So sometimes you just need someone in your corner that isn't in that emotional spot to say, don't you sign that. Don't you agree to that. You know, hold strong and look at this impact. So that's then specifically some things I see. Outside of divorce, just women in general approaching retirement, a lot of times women tend to save for their kids' education and over their own retirement. I see that a lot. And support adult children. They've graduated, they're working, and they're still paying for cell phone plans, they're still paying for car insurance, they're still paying for whatever. That's okay if they can afford it. But when we look under the hood of their financial car, what's driving them to retirement, sometimes they really can't afford that.
I've lost a few clients with that advice. Really?
It's important to face it because it's a reality for a lot of people. I think the other thing, Chrissy, you were making a point earlier before the show started about the fact that women, sometimes as women, you know, if we have families, if we're raising children, we take time out of the workforce. So there's time away from saving for our own retirement. And our life expectancies could be a little longer sometimes than our husbands, perhaps. We always say, you know, plan to be single because there's a high divorce rate in our country. We have a lot of widows who end up in poverty. You know, the poverty rate for women is statistically higher than it is for men. And I think it's because we underestimate what we need to save as women.
Yeah, actually last year, 2010 Census Bureau data, women over age 65 below the poverty line. In general, 10.7% of overall women. If they're living with a spouse, that drops to 4%. If they're widowed, it jumps to 17%. And if they're divorced, it's over 20%. So
do that again. Those are the
women. That's crazy. Percentage of women over age 65 that are living below the poverty line. Overall women, about 10-11%. Living with a living spouse, 4%. Widowed, 17%. Divorced, over 20%. So divorce is painful for women. We need to be careful, not just emotionally, but financially. And of course, we need to plan for widowhood. And the biggest thing is when you're going through that transition, when you lose a spouse, whether it's to divorce or death, getting some immediate advice and handholding on how to rebuild and what changes need to be made to get you healthy in the future.
There's a publication Social Security has called What Every Woman Should Know About Social Security. You can get it at socialsecurity.gov. And it does give you those basics of that one leg of your financial planning stool, which is Social Security. It's so important to so many retirees, and 60% of all Social Security recipients are women. So it's actually more than half of all checks go to women. So that's another publication you could start with to get the understanding of the basics.
Okay, how does somebody know that they don't know?
They don't know that they don't know. Now, hopefully shows like this, Bob, I love, I've been listening to your shows for a while, and just throwing out some of these ideas, some of these things that hopefully, that maybe people have never heard of, and they think, wow, you know, there might be something out there that I don't know that could help me. And so talking to advisors, talking to somebody that knows, yeah. And on Social Security, I know a lot of women that don't know, or people that are divorced that don't know, if your spouse made a lot more than you and you were married more than 10 years, that you're entitled to taking a spousal benefit for Social Security, and they don't have to know about it. You don't have to be married.
No longer married, right? Because if your spouse has remarried, their spouse can collect benefits as the spouse, but you as the former spouse can also collect benefits, and they could be exactly the same amount. And none of those benefits get reduced. Both the spouse, the person who earned the benefit, and even the former spouse.
And your ex doesn't even have to know.
No, they wouldn't know. Right. Just contact Social Security.
But how would Social Security know?
You contact Social Security directly, and you say,
"I was the divorced spouse's Social Security number and divorce decree, marriage."
They can
find it. Social Security knows everybody's number.
Yeah, before you divorce, make sure you know your spouse's social.
That was a comment to y'all listening, and Andrew's giving us a comment. We have less than a minute, so Tammy, let's bring it down to a slow landing.
I just think that the whole topic of this session today is you don't know what you don't know. And I think learning more, you can save yourself some money and come out a winner.
All righty, Christy.
If you have any questions about anything that was said today, there are a lot of people in this area that can talk to you. If you'd like to contact our office, our number is 703-986-3490. Again, 703-986-3490, or you can email.
Okay, great. Thanks for being here, and we'll be back next week, October 15th, my favorite day of the year, because it's over then. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.